It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the latest in election news with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First this week, the State Department of Administration released Wisconsin's annual fiscal report, which showed general spending was less than anticipated. Governor Walker's administration announced the fiscal year ended with a $313 million positive balance.
But this good news comes without spending reports from all of the state agencies. Molly Beck reported on this, and she's here to share the details. She's a Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
So this report is 35 pages long. It's on the fiscal year that just ended June 30th. What do we know about this surplus?
Well, the report showed that there was about $313 million in a positive balance for the general fund. And when you page through the report, there was a footnote in there that said that agencies are continuing to work on their final numbers of revenues and spending, and therefore adjustments to the report may become necessary in the future.
So, go ahead. Yeah, well, why was the report issued if not all agencies contributed their final numbers?
Agencies did contribute their numbers, they're just not finalized, so they could change, and they have to issue this report by law, so it's you know, state law mandated that they do this. So that's why it's released every year. But depending on how different, you know, those final numbers are, that surplus could grow or shrink.
And this is a new year with a new accounting system. How does this report compare to other years?
So in other years, it's not very much different. It's just the fact that they're using this new way of tracking everything. And I know that it's, you know, a multi-million dollar software program that they've had some delays in. There's been some trouble. It's not working properly, but they're using it now. So I'm told that that's the reason that this is a little delayed.
And so last month, the Revenue Department and the Fiscal Bureau made an announcement about tax collections. How is that different than the annual fiscal report?
So that's a projection. It's more of a projection than what comes out in the annual fiscal report, and that's supposed to be kind of the final numbers heading into the next year ahead of, you know, 2017 and the new budget process that's going to be starting in 2017. So when that came out in September, it showed that tax collections fell about $85 million short of the estimates that were available earlier. So this shows that there is a surplus, but it's supposed to be more of a final report than that was.
So the Department of Administration must be feeling pretty good about seeing black in this, instead of being in the red. What did Governor Walker say about the report?
He was touting that on social media. I believe there was something on Facebook, maybe on Twitter about it. So it looks like that they're using this number as, you know, something that they think is pretty secure.
And, you know, Molly, it seems like this fiscal surplus is a world away from 5 years ago when we had Act 10 in the midst and when the state was facing this multi-billion dollar deficit. How has Wisconsin turned around its budget so quickly?
So the deficit heading into the passage of Act 10 was about $3 billion, and that was largely created by the recession, rocking sales and income tax collections. And the former governor, Jim Doyle, he was using accounting gimmicks and federal stimulus funding to balance the budget for 2009-2011, that budget. So when Act 10 was passed, that required public employees to contribute to their health insurance and their pensions, which went a long way to closing that budget gap. But as the economy improved and tax collections rebounded, the state developed a surplus, which Republicans used to cut income taxes by about $800 million in the 13-15 budget. And since then, tax growth has slowed And Medicaid costs have continued to swell, and that's why 2 years ago Governor Walker had to solve a $2 billion shortfall. So at this point, we'll find out, you know, at the end of November, what kind of surplus the governor has to work with next biennium.
Yeah, and so really it's next month and the next 30 days that we'll really get a clear picture about the, you know, the biennium. And are we expecting more surpluses?
I think, you know, Governor Walker, he's expecting that there will be, you know, there won't be another huge shortfall like he had to solve 2 years ago. But like I said, we'll see at the end of November what kind of surplus he has, and another, you know, a comprehensive annual financial report will come out in early January, which will give us a better clue too.
Molly, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Molly Beck, Capital reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about a new report on the state budget.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, with less than a month to go in the presidential election, we find out what's on the minds of one prized voting group, undecided voters.
Right now, the countdown continues, 19 days away from Election Day. Tonight, the two main party presidential candidates, Republican Donald Trump, Democrat Hillary Clinton, will debate one final time.
But where are the candidates in the polls, and how could the debate change things? And then how are things looking in the race for the U.S. Senate?
Joining us now, as he does every week, to try to answer that kind of question is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. Only 20 days to go. Oh, thank God.
The clock is ticking. Yeah, Harry, and 20 days out, what do the polls look like nationally and key battleground states?
I mean, if we're talking about the presidential race, it's very clear that Hillary Clinton continues to lead that by a wide margin. Our national estimate has her up by about 7 percentage points. And then if you go swing state by swing state, she's pretty much leading in all of them. She has small leads in, say, a state like Ohio, but she has very large leads in states like Colorado and Virginia. And when you put it all together, she looks like she's, at this point, if the polls are correct, heading for at least 330 electoral votes, if not 350. And, of course, you only need 270 to win.
Last debate tonight, you wrote pretty recently about the impact of third debates. We don't have a huge sample to draw from here, but looking at recent history, what do you see?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, we only have six prior debates to go from, but if you look at those, the average debate has only shifted things by maybe a point and a half. That, of course, is not anywhere close to the lead that Hillary Clinton has right now. There was one debate in 1992 that shifted things more significantly, but there was a third-party candidate or an independent candidate in Ross Perot, and we obviously don't have that this time around. It's just going to be Trump and Clinton. So I just don't really see, unless something crazy happens, and this year has been crazy, this debate being a game changer.
Yeah, so even if Donald Trump comes out of this debate the consensus winner, the benefit, the likely gain from that is not enough to bridge that gap, it sounds like.
Exactly right. I mean, third debates, historically speaking, have had less impact than either the first or the second, which makes sense because usually fewer people tune into the third debate. And by this point, voters know what's going on. They've seen these two candidates debate twice before, so it shouldn't be too surprising that a third debate, at least historically speaking, has had far less of an impact than either one or two.
Right. Are we close enough to the election now that, you know, the undecided voters, the numbers are getting smaller? People are pretty much, if they've made up their minds, they're going to stay with what they've got, barring, I don't know what. We're pretty much locked in as voters at this point.
Usually the answer is yes. Now, obviously, you could potentially point to something like 1948, where maybe that wasn't the case. But even in that year with Dewey defeating Truman, but in fact, it was Truman defeating Dewey. Even in that year, the polling error was not anywhere near what we would need right now for Donald Trump to be able to come back on Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, you wrote about that Dewey-Truman election. There's the famous headline, Dewey beats Truman. It's the other way around. Or as the Onion headline said, what's-his-face defeats the other guy, something like that. And I guess you're hearing from people saying, hey, what about Dewey-Truman? Maybe that's Trump-Clinton this time around.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the, not surprisingly, the thing that candidates who are always losing or the fans of candidates that are always losing like to point to. Oh, all the polls had Dewey winning, but Truman won in the end, and we're hearing that a little bit this year. I know I had a few emails earlier in my inbox earlier this week, but the fact is that that is somewhat of a myth. If you look at the polls where they were right now, although Truman was behind Thomas Dewey, it was only about a 3.5-point deficit. Donald Trump's deficit right now is double that. So he's going to need a lot more than that type of error to be able to come back and win this election.
And polling, it sounds like, was a lot fewer and further between in 1948 than it is now.
Yeah, I mean, look, there were only four pollsters that were active in the month of October of 1948. Right now, I think there were five polls that came out between noon and 1 o'clock Eastern time today. So, there's just a lot more numbers to crunch these days. There are a lot more polls. The polling techniques are different now. You know, you call people on the phone. You randomly select participants. Back then, it was basically, oh, I just need X number of African Americans or X number of females, and I'm just going to go and find the first five females that I see. Very different now. Just don't, that type of error could happen, but the techniques are so different that it probably won't.
Another critique it sounds like you're hearing is, oh, but what about Brexit over in the UK? The Brexit polls were saying that Remain in the EU was going to win. You say not really, though.
Not really. This is a great case where conventional wisdom, in fact, kind of sort of shadowed what the polls were actually saying. The betting markets all had Remain winning. But if you look at the polls during the month of June, and remember Brexit, the Brexit vote was held, I believe, on June 23rd. If you look at the polls taken during the month of June, 17 of the polls had Leave winning versus only 14 that had Remain winning. It was just that a lot of people couldn't believe it could possibly happen. And so it was a case where they were ignoring the polls. And I think the lesson from that isn't to ignore the polls, it's to believe the polls. And that's what we're doing right now with this race. And that says Hillary Clinton's well ahead of Donald Trump.
Let's talk about some recent things that might be affecting polls. There was the Trump Access Hollywood video, a handful of women saying the things he said he did in that video, he did to me. Can we measure our polls specific enough to say, hey, yeah, that is hurting Trump in the polls?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not helping Trump in the polls. What we've basically seen is a continuous upswing for Hillary Clinton since the first debate. I think it's very clear that that first debate helped her in any number of ways. I think it shifted voters, but it also made Democrats more likely to turn out. And, of course, that's the name of the game. It doesn't matter if you have support. If they don't turn out, it doesn't mean anything. I think the other things that you mentioned certainly did not help Donald Trump. There's some question as to whether it really hurt him. But if you look at the polls, for instance, the Quinnipiac poll that came out today showed that the majority of voters believe the women who said that Trump committed sexual assault against them. They do not believe Donald Trump.
And on Hillary Clinton's side, we've seen a steady stream of these WikiLeaks hacked emails from Democratic insiders, campaign staff for Hillary Clinton. Is that the sort of thing you would anticipate would hurt her, raise her negatives, turn people away from her, discourage potential supporters?
Well, I mean, if the other candidate wasn't someone who threatened to arrest the other candidate on stage during a debate, then, yeah, that type of thing would probably hurt her. But the fact is that there's all the attention is on Donald Trump. If you look, for instance, at Gallup's polling, right, you see that more people have said consistently that they have seen Donald Trump's name in the news than Hillary Clinton's. And given how unpopular Donald Trump is, he is basically overshadowing any of the negative news coming out against Clinton, and it's basically killing his candidacy.
And then Donald Trump on the campaign trail here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and in speeches around the country has been raising this idea that the election would be rigged. Part of that, he says, is the media colluding with the Clinton campaign, but he has specifically said rigged at polling places. And there's been a lot of experts have weighed in on this. What would it take to successfully sway an election by rigging the voting at polling places?
I have to admit, Donald Trump has said many things during this campaign that were untrue, but this is probably, and I speak as someone who, if I ever to take a job in government, I'd love to be an election official, rings the most untrue, because we have 50 statewide elections. We have, under those 50 statewide elections, there are county boards that control everything. And more than that, more than 270 electoral votes in states that contain more than 270 electoral votes, they're controlled by Republican secretaries of state. What are they, in on the rigging too? It makes no sense. This is just somebody who is upset that he's losing, and it's a completely garbage and baseless claim.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com with the latest news from the campaign trail. Let's step away from the presidential campaign for a minute, Harry. We'll come back to it, I promise. The Senate. People are wondering, you know, Democrats are trying to take the Senate back from Republicans. They need some seats to do that. This growing gap, apparently, between Clinton and Trump should, in theory, be helping Democratic Senate candidates. Is it?
The picture is mixed. If you asked me a week ago, I'd say it wasn't, but we are seeing some movement towards some Democratic candidates in some swing states. Two that I'm specifically looking at that are very interesting to me are actually not states that are swing states on the presidential level, but they are in the Senate races. That is Indiana and Missouri. Indiana, of course, Evan Bayh is running to reclaim his old seat in that state. And then in Missouri, the incumbent Roy Blunt is facing off against the Republican incumbent Roy Blunt is facing off against Jason Kander, the Secretary of State. And it does seem in both of those states there has been some movement towards the Democratic Party, and that's very big because, remember, Democrats need a net gain of 4 if Hillary Clinton wins, and it looks like right now they're probably going to get it. I can't tell you the exact states, but the movement in the polls in those two states, plus in the state of Nevada, where Harry Reid's seat is up, he's obviously retiring, the movement there towards the Democratic candidate, three states, very good news for Democrats.
What are you looking at here in Wisconsin in the Johnson-Feingold race? We've had their two debates now. That's their second and final one just last night. Marquette poll, the one that's been pretty consistent every few weeks, showed a tiding race with Feingold just a two-point lead. A couple other polls have come out since then. What do you make of the Wisconsin U.S. Senate race?
Well, I would say that, you know, obviously Russ Feingold has held a very consistent lead pretty much throughout that race. I think there was only one poll that had Russ Feingold behind. That was that Loras College poll a few weeks ago. The Marquette poll obviously showed some tightening, but there have been some polls released since the Marquette poll came out. One of them was the Monmouth poll that came out earlier today, and it showed that Russ Feingold had a near 10-point lead. I believe it was 8 percentage points. So to me, that's a race that Democrats will almost certainly pick up. Johnson has closed the gap, but I think it's probably a little bit too late for him.
All right, I want to turn to Utah and the candidate who could be the next leader of the free world, Evan McMullen. Independent candidate, unhappy, who considers himself a conservative Republican, unhappy with the Donald Trump candidacy he's running. What's he doing in the polls?
I think that this is probably the most interesting sort of subplot of this election. You know, you mentioned, and Utah is a state that Donald Trump did horribly in the primary season. The caucus, I think he got something like 14% of the vote. He came in third place. Mormon voters hate Donald Trump. They're obviously, they make up the majority of the voters in the state of Utah. And for the first time ever, we had a poll today that had Evan McMullen leading in the state of Utah in a three-way race with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And it seems to me that he has a decent shot of winning that state, and that would be 6 electoral votes for Evan McMullen, the first third-party candidate to win a state since 1968, and the first third-party candidate to win a state outside of the Deep South since 1924, when, of course, the state that was won by the independent candidate was the state of Wisconsin.
And Evan McMullen, there is a sequence of events that could lead to, if he won Utah and had those 6 electoral votes in his pocket, there's a sequence of events that could lead to him being president. If, right, neither Clinton nor Trump can lock down that majority, if it's tight, they're both in the 260-something range, McMullen gets the rest, then it goes to the House of Representatives.
Right. You get to the House of Representatives, you need to be one of the 3 top electoral vote getters. McMullen would be number 3 in that particular instance. And then it would be a situation where the House, where each state casts one vote, and it's possible that McMullen could be the compromise candidate between Trump and Clinton and could somehow win. Will it happen? Almost certainly not. But then again, if you'd asked me a year ago, I would say no chance that Trump would be the Republican nominee. So we'll see.
You're not emptying out the bank account and putting it on President McMullen getting inaugurated in January.
I'm not. I am emptying out my bank account, but for other reasons besides that. But we won't get into that.
That seems reasonable. Now, you had a chat at 5:38 looking at Hillary Clinton's lead in the polls, what she's looking at in the Electoral College. You had a little debate. Should she concentrate on the closer states that she needs to win, or should she try to expand her electoral map? Because states like Texas are close. There are states that should be in the bag for Republicans usually that might be up for grabs. Sum up some of the talking points there.
Well, I think it's essentially what Hillary Clinton's trying to do. If she thinks that she has this election in the bag, then obviously she should try and expand her sort of mandate, right? The bigger she wins by, theoretically, you'd think she'd have more of a mandate to govern. More than that, she could help out some down-ballot Democrats. And, you know, if she does well in the state, we obviously have seen an increasingly strong relationship between how the presidential candidates does and then how they do in Congress and perhaps even the state houses. So that would be an argument for expanding and going full in. However, you don't get really extra points at the end of the day for getting more than 270 electoral votes. The most important thing that Hillary Clinton needs to do at this particular time is win the election. And if she wants to win the election, then she needs to concentrate on the closest states. So it's this back and forth of basically what do you want to do. But I think Clinton's at the point right now that she's leading by so much that it probably is worth her time to invest in some of these pinkish states, perhaps not Texas, but states like Arizona and Georgia, which have been Trump-leaning but still very close.
Let's talk about the coattail effect a little more. Both, we've mentioned this a bunch of times, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have very high negatives for a presidential candidate. Do you think there are a lot of candidates, Senate, Congress, House out there, who don't want that? They're actually more popular than the presidential candidate. They'd actually be a drag if they were seen together.
Well, I think it's certainly the case for the Republican nominees that they really want very little to do with Donald Trump. You know, you saw obviously Kelly Ayotte a few weeks ago, who's the Republican senator from New Hampshire, struggling to, you know, answer a question of whether Donald Trump should be looked up to by children as a role model. So she wants no part of that. We've seen in Nevada, for instance, Joe Heck, who's running for Harry Reid's seat, the Republican out there, very worried about being tied to Trump, and he doesn't quite know which way to do it because he doesn't want to alienate the Trump voters on the right, but at the same time, he doesn't want to alienate those voters in the center. So I think for Republicans, it's a much different thing where they're very worried about being tied to Trump. For Clinton, I think that Democrats realize, especially in a state, say, like North Carolina, where turnout is everything, that they want the strongest vote possible for Hillary Clinton. And so Deborah Ross is very much hoping that she gets some coattails from Clinton because Clinton's likely to carry the state. And if Ross gets the same voters as Clinton, then she's going to be on her way to the United States Senate.
And finally, Harry, the U.S. House, when we came into this election, people thought, oh, maybe Democrats have a shot at the Senate, the House, no way. It seems like they're saying maybe a way, maybe there's a path to Democrats controlling the House as we wrap up, is there?
Maybe. Better shot than it was 12 months ago, but still not very much of a shot. They'll probably almost certainly pick up some seats upwards of 20, but they need much closer to 30 to be able to pull it off. That probably isn't going to happen, which means Paul Ryan will probably still be the Speaker of the House come January.
More likely than an Evan McMullen presidency, but still not very likely.
I think that is exactly the way that I would put it.
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He joined us to talk about the latest in national politics and the race for the White House.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the psychology of undecided voters in 2016. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, some Wisconsin tribes are opposing the expansion of a casino in Shawano County. We'll find out what's at stake.
First, we're just a few weeks out from Election Day, and there are still people who don't know who they're going to vote for in the presidential race or whether they'll vote at all. Saturday Night Live took a swing at what's going on in the minds of undecided voters in their weekend update with a couple of undecided voters from Philadelphia, played by Tina Fey and Jimmy Fallon.
So, ladies, how does it feel to be the most sought-after voters in the country right now?
I think it's
fun.
And have you decided who you're going to vote for?
Colin, I'm torn from a scooter accident, but I don't know who I'm going to vote for.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know. I think they're both bad.
Our next guest looks at the makeup of undecided voters and finds out what might motivate them to cast their votes for a candidate.
Chris Wells joins us now. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He studies political communication with an emphasis on social media and public opinion. Chris, thanks for joining us today in studio.
Thanks for having me.
So here we are, 3 weeks out from Election Day. How many undecided voters do we think are still out there?
There's a few. It depends a little bit who we're really talking about when we say undecided voter. So often in polls, we kind of group together a few different folks. So there are some people who really don't know who they're going to vote for, who are still trying to decide between the candidates. But then we're also in that group. There are folks who just say that they aren't going to vote. They've decided not to. And then others who say that they will, but they're not going to vote for either of the main candidates.
And here in Wisconsin, do we know what that pool looks like of undecided voters?
Yeah, sure. So the number that are actually undecided, like they plan to vote for one of the candidates but haven't decided, is now pretty small. It's down around 3 or 4%, maybe 5%, in Wisconsin. There's a bigger group, though, that says that they have decided who they're going to vote for, and it's not either of the main candidates. That group is around 6% or higher of the public in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that undecided, right. And so where do they fall on party allegiance? Are these undecideds more likely to be Democrat, Republican, or this third party candidate?
Well, there's some of both. So the classic undecided voter is often an independent. So in most models of elections, people who haven't decided yet tend not to be very engaged. And so along with that are people who haven't got very stable kind of partisan identities and aren't involved in other forms of politics, like gathering news and so forth. And so they're the largest part. But this election is a little unique in that there are dissatisfied voters on both sides. So there are Republicans, traditional Republicans, who aren't all that happy with Trump. And then on Clinton's side, there are also a substantial number of folks who aren't happy with Clinton and so are making another decision there. So you see it kind of all across the spectrum, although for different reasons.
And often, you know, there's that big grab for the millennial vote. Bernie Sanders' camp, of course, was a magnet for millennials. What are the millennials looking like in the undecided voter category?
Yeah, so millennials are really interesting for the reasons you just mentioned. First, they tend to be less engaged overall because they're younger, so that pushes them into being more likely to be undecided. But then their heavy support for Bernie Sanders adds to that this year. So according to the recent Marquette Law School poll that came out a week ago, 16% of 18 to 29-year-olds actually fall in the group of folks that they're not going to vote for either of the two main candidates anyway. So that's a big percentage. And then additional groups say that they don't know who they're going to vote for or that they won't vote at all. So that's one in five millennials who are still up for grabs or maybe out of the running, as it were, for Clinton and Trump.
And we keep hearing that some voters say they won't really know who they're voting for until they're staring down that ballot. Is there truth to that? Or do you think even the most undecided voter really knows, you know, how they're leaning before then?
Yeah, I mean, you sometimes sort of wonder if they're saying that to get all the attention because, you know, they get represented on SNL and they get kind of their own debate, right,
yeah,
when they get to ask questions. There's been a lot of talk about these undecideds in this election. I think that actually the portion that are in that group is narrowing pretty considerably now. So even in August and September, there was a lot of talk about how surprising it was that the undecided numbers were still relatively high in the 15, 16, 17% range. But again, according to the most recent Marquette poll, that's coming down into fairly reasonable numbers of 6, 7, 8% of all those undecideds.
And then one thing you study is this concept of individualism. You know, one of the qualities that's especially pronounced in undecided voters. Can you talk a little bit about this sense of individualism?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's especially pronounced in undecided voters, but it's a big part of the sort of more general shifts in our political culture. So the last 30, 40 years, there's been a big deinstitutionalization of our political culture, where people are less comfortable being represented by big groups, by parties, or by civic organizations, and feel more of a responsibility to make their political decisions on their own. So that's a larger trend that will lead people toward independent voting, because they don't want to feel that they're Democrats beholden to always voting the party line. And so as a result, we see fewer and fewer people identifying with a party if they're asked, are you a Republican or are you a Democrat? And that's especially strong among millennials. And then that just feeds into being undecided at election time.
So they have this value that they should uphold, that is, keep their options open?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's keeping your options open, but it also winds up entailing kind of a search for a pure candidate. So everybody's looking for the candidate that represents them on every issue and every event. And with two candidates, that's pretty hard for a lot of citizens to find that perfect person. So I think people wind up with some conflicting emotions. They wind up liking a candidate for some reasons, but being uncomfortable for others. And whereas in a sort of previous era of our politics, their identity as a Democrat or Republican or maybe a union member would have overridden those other factors. Now, since that identity is much more individualized and you have more responsibility for your own choice, it can become difficult at the ballot box.
Talk to me a little bit about the undecided voter in the context of, you know, the Bernie Sanders crush and, you know, supporters who were not sure if they're ready to support a Hillary Clinton presidency. How does that play out here in the undecided voter realm?
Yeah, so that's certainly playing out here. As I mentioned, there's some of this going on both sides of the spectrum. So Trump, for a different set of reasons, is struggling a little bit with his supporters. But again, that most recent Marquette Law School poll from a week ago actually showed that people who identified as very liberal politically were less decided on Clinton than people who just said that they were liberal, sort of solidly liberal. And a greater portion of that very liberal group, 15% of them actually, said that they would vote for neither Trump nor Clinton. So there's some evidence that Clinton is still struggling to bring in that the sort of left or more part of her or her party. But on the other hand, if you look at overall support, if you look at Democrats, they're going strongly for Clinton, 90%+. Trump is struggling a little bit more with around 75% to 80% of Republican support. So Clinton has a little bit of that issue, but it's happening on both sides and may not wind up being decisive.
And then, you know, you love numbers, you crunch the numbers, you're looking at all this polling data. Is there anything that at this point is really popping out at you that really intrigues you?
So that's the biggest thing would be that most of these folks that we consider undecided are not undecided. It's more that they're dissatisfied. So that group of folks who are saying neither candidate is much bigger than the group that says that they won't vote or they don't know. We have two very unfavorable candidates in the public's mind. So it's often been said that Clinton would be the most disliked candidate ever to run for president if it weren't for Donald Trump. So they're both record-setting in terms of their unfavorables.
We're talking with UW-Madison journalism professor Chris Wells about the psychology of the undecided voter.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you still undecided in this year's election? What's holding you back from making your decision? What could sway your vote? And in general, your voting style, are you that individual style voter? You want to make up your own mind? You don't care what that party or that interest group thinks? Or are you a card-carrying member of a particular political party? You'd vote for them if they put up a mannequin to run for a particular office. Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with UW-Madison journalism professor Chris Wells about the psychology of the undecided voter.
And we want to hear from you. Are you still undecided in this year's presidential election? What is holding you back? What do you need to know that you don't know? Or what's going to sway your vote? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Chris, you know, one big change between this year and previous generations is you say a lot of young people may volunteer, but it's much more likely they haven't been part of a civic organization. What difference does that make?
That's a great question. So this has been a big debate in the political science community. When we look at civic engagement and we try to say how is that changing and is it declining, especially among younger people, there's a big debate about that. And there's clear evidence that sort of membership organizations are declining. So the Elks Club you might have been involved in or the union from several decades ago, much less so. But it's not that people are spending less time overall. They might be volunteering. But the big difference between volunteering and being a member of an organization is that when you volunteer, you typically come into a setting, you do some work, and you leave. There's not a lot of political dynamics, so you don't have to deal with conflict about somebody else wanting the organization's direction to go a different way from you. Or being a member of a committee where there's contentiousness and disagreement. Usually volunteering is more civic. You do it and you're doing some good, but there's not that potential for conflict. But the thing about the conflict in the politics is that being in that organization, we think, gives people a lot of experience with how to deal with others, how to come to compromises and find solutions. And that's an experience that maybe people aren't having enough now. So that when they look at the political world and they see these candidates who are inevitably compromised in some way, it may be more difficult to appreciate the sort of problems that they face, the problems of compromise and trying to achieve things. So that may be a reason that people's kind of home experiences in volunteering versus other kinds of civic activism might actually be the way they shape how they view the larger political world.
Yeah. Let's take a caller, Mark from Toma. What do you have to say, Mark?
Hi, my name is Mark. I'm calling. I'm 52 years old, and I've been voting since I've been able to vote, and I lean more towards the right, but this year it's almost like I have to pick the best out of the worst two candidates I could possibly choose. I'm leaning more towards Trump. I'm still undecided. My mother, she's a Catholic, and she wants Hillary, and I say, well, she's not pro-life, and I don't know, this cycle of voting, I feel the country as a whole is just kind of going downhill. It's like, I just don't understand. I'll take my answer or whatever off the air.
And so what do you have to say there about Mark? Very conflicted. And of course, family plays into it as well, where, you know, we're hearing about families, you know, one person not talking to another person for days on end after a debate.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear that your caller is still talking to his mom about the election.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Mark is really a one-caller poll. I think that's the way a lot of people are feeling in terms of having been an active citizen for his whole life, as he describes, but now being fairly unsatisfied, it sounds like, with his usual party's candidate, but finding the other one not any better and maybe a little bit worse. That's, I think, a pretty typical view of somebody who's now in this place. So again, to emphasize the typical undecided voter from a usual campaign is somebody who's not paying attention, hasn't been engaged a lot. But as Mark illustrates, it's also people who are struggling between two candidates that they don't find so appealing.
Yeah, and let's take another call. We have Joe calling from Durand. Joe, hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say that for the purposes of your discussion, I would be considered an undecided voter. However, I have made my decision to essentially pledge my vote to Jill Stein. And a lot of that is just based on research, actually, researching all four candidates. And the reason I can only vote for Jill Stein is because she's the only non-interventionist candidate with her foreign policy. She's also strongly opposed to TPP. And unlike, you know, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, I can actually feel like I can trust her when she says that she's opposed to that. Thank you.
And, you know, what do we have to say for, you know, policy and really, you know, aligning with policy in this election and going for the candidate where that is authentic with, you know, putting policy first?
Yeah. So we sometimes distinguish between what we refer to as sort of expressive voting and strategic voting. So expressive voting would go along with more with the individualism ideas that we were talking about earlier, where, you know, as Joe's describing, he's really trying to find the candidate that aligns most closely with his own beliefs. And he's discovered through his research that that's Jill Stein. Strategic voting, on the other hand, would look maybe less at the absolute amount of correlation between the candidate's policies and your own views, and take into account the other factors. And the major factor here is that Jill Stein is polling at around 3% and clearly is not going to win Wisconsin or any state. And so a strategic voter would take into account that Clinton deviates from Joe's views on probably a lot of issues, but that overall, between the choices that are plausibly going to be elected, she might align more with Joe's views than Trump. Maybe not, I don't know for sure, but that would be a more strategic view of the choice.
Another area you look at is our culture of commercialism and how a kind of customer-centered approach to politics. How does that go into the mix to create, you know, today's undecided voter?
Yeah, so I think that goes along with some of the individualism theme that we were just talking about. What consumer culture is really, really good at is delivering what we want on an individual basis. Today we can go on Amazon, and the next day or in a couple of days we'll have the perfect thing that we ordered. You're not going to get the perfect candidate that you ordered in politics. It just doesn't work the same way. So my suspicion is that there's a bit of a conflict, that when citizens really become habituated to consumer culture, they begin to demand and expect immediate and very satisfying gratification. President Obama actually addressed this yesterday or the day before when he spoke to some leaders from Silicon Valley, and he contrasted the problems that he faced as president from the ones that they faced. And he really emphasized that as executives in Silicon Valley, they have to produce a good product, but they can produce any product that will suit a market and that people will be happy with. He has to deal with competing factions. So he has to make sure that it works for the powerful interests, but that it doesn't hurt poor people, and that it can be distributed equitably, and that it doesn't cause problems for somebody else, and all these issues of politics. So my concern is that if we become too habituated to that consumer culture, we start to have trouble dealing with some of the issues that are just inherent with politics.
And we're talking with Chris Wells, who is a journalism professor, digs into the psychology of the undecided voter. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you still undecided in this year's election? And if so, what's holding you back from making your decision? Let's go to Lou now in northern Wisconsin. Hello, Lou.
Hi, good afternoon. Really, what would make me happy would be for all the votes to count, for everyone's vote to be honored and respected. If Bernie was on the ballots in all the states, then I would seriously consider casting my vote. Right now, I'm very undecided and very disgusted with our government and the way things are run. Just seeing how the primaries were run is just intolerable, and it should not be allowed to happen anymore. We need to let go of Electoral College and redo the voting system all the way. All the votes need to be respected for each candidate. And there's not just two. There are many more candidates. We need to get rid of the parties. Thank you.
And Chris, you know, what would you say about the electoral system and just, you know, this angst over, how the politicians go forward and, in running for president?
Yeah, so a lot of issues the caller brought up there. One of them has to do with the way that the parties are set up. So there's a difference between the way that the parties run their primaries, and that's largely an organizational, a nonprofit issue in terms of the way the Democrats and the Republicans choose their candidates. But there is a governance structure there. So one way to address that would be to get involved in the party process, to be involved with, in this caller's case, maybe with the Democrats and how they go about allocating their candidates and choosing their votes and delegates and so forth. That became an interesting issue this year because Bernie chose to run as a Democrat. So he could have run as an independent, and he said early on that he would not, so that he wouldn't be a spoiler to Secretary Clinton. But that would be one way to go about it. The caller is also describing some really fundamental changes, really constitutional level changes to things like the Electoral College. In terms of going about that, that is going to be a very long process, whoever is the candidate. But if the caller or someone else is interested in that, most of those movements start at a low level, at a
grassroots.
At a grassroots level, absolutely, the county party level, and then work up.
So do you think this year's undecided voters have the potential to swing the election at all?
Well, it's a good question. So as I mentioned earlier, the folks who are still in the don't know category are pretty small, especially compared to the margins that most of the polls are showing between the major candidates. So it doesn't look too likely. The one thing that could make a big difference is if those folks who lean left, who have really rejected Clinton, suddenly get on board, or if vice versa, the Republicans who so far aren't happy with Trump suddenly jump on his bandwagon.
And that could happen 3 weeks before an election, 2 weeks, 1 week, 24 hours?
I mean, so making predictions in this election has turned out to be a very dangerous proposition. So I probably wouldn't like to predict.
Put a time frame on it.
Yeah, so we don't have a lot of precedents for something like this. Maybe the one to point to would be the 2000 and Bush versus Gore. And in that case, in a couple of key states, the votes for Nader, although not all that great, because a couple states were decided by, what was Florida, 100 and something votes. That did make the difference there. So it's certainly something to consider if the election were that close.
Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Chris Wells. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us to talk about the psychology of undecided voters in this election year.
And you can share your thoughts still at the Central Time Facebook page. If you're undecided, let us know what you're looking for. That's the Central Time Facebook page. With Halloween coming up, we got some recommendations yesterday for scary movies from film critic Reggie Ponder.
And we've still got scary movies on our mind, and you shared more of your favorites on social media.
On Facebook, John picks the movie It, based on the Stephen King novel. Why? John says one word, clowns.
Clowns. Ahmed says anything with kids being the focus, The Ring, Exorcist, that does add an element of creepiness.
And on Twitter, Bridget picks, she has a list, Jaws, The Serpent and the Rainbow, Amityville Horror, and a movie with George C. Scott, I haven't heard of this one, called The Changeling. And I thought of some more after the show yesterday that we didn't get into, the funny scary movies.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a genre you like.
Well, you know, funny helps kind of tone down the scary part, so that's always a good thing.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of going back, and these might be kid appropriate now, A Fright Night,
uh-huh.
Some of the old funny vampire movies. A Lost Boys was a good one, a young Kiefer Sutherland as kind of an evil spoiler alert. He turns out to be a vampire. You find that out pretty soon. And maybe not quite kid appropriate yet, but I could always do with another viewing of Shaun of the Dead.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite funny / horror movies. So you're queuing up all your horror movies at home for Halloween?
Netflix, yes, indeed.
All right, out with the music of John Carpenter here on Central Time.